calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And happy Thomas Jefferson birthday, my friends. Today, the birthday of Thomas Jefferson, we will be exploring Jefferson and his life and some of the things he left us that have consequence today as we continue on with the program. Later on in the second hour of our program, David Smith is going to be on with his new book, Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequence. However, in the first hour here, Steve Malloy is with us. He's an adjunct fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, website freeenterpriseactionfund.com, and of course, CEI.org, the Competitive Enterprise Institute.org. And should corporations be responsible to we the people? Question. Steve, you took on, and on the one hand, I want to salute you for your activism. I think people should be activists. On the other hand, you and I have a different perspective on this stuff, but you took on Goldman Sachs recently.
Uh-huh.
Tell us about that. You took on, actually, Hank Paulson, the CEO of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, well, we took on the CEO for two main reasons. One, it appeared to us that he was using shareholder assets for his personal hobbies, which include, he's an environmental activist, and so he's using shareholder monies to fulfill that hobby of his. And then the other thing is,
well, that's just specifically what that was that Goldman Sachs bought 680,000 acres of land in Chile and then donated it to the Wildlife Conservation Society.
Right.
And he is the chairman of the Nature Conservancy, which works with the society, and his daughter's on the society's board of directors.
Right. And the Nature Conservancy is an environmental activist group. And as chairman of the Nature Conservancy, he's taken its agenda and transplanted it into Goldman Sachs.
Right. So you don't object to his taking millions of dollars in salary and stock options and flying around on the corporate jet with the gold-plated faucets. That doesn't bother you. What bothers you is the fact that he gave some land to the Nature Conservancy.
Well,
question. You're a stockholder.
Hank Paulson makes a lot of money for his stockholders. The compensation can be, lots of CEOs, their compensation can appear to be excessive. We think that the relative harm to shareholders in Goldman Sachs from the his salary is a lot less than what he's doing by taking the Nature Conservancy agenda and making that Goldman Sachs agenda. We think that's
How much did that 680,000 acres cost?
Well, Goldman valued it at $35 million. I think that it's worth actually a lot more because it had all sorts of natural resources that could have been exploited by the people of Chile that won't be exploited now. We've got some more information coming on this later. I don't want to get into too many details, but Goldman, it's worth at least $35 million.
So your argument here, we're talking with Steve Malloy of Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Your argument basically boils down to a corporation really has no business being in the philanthropy business, that corporations shouldn't be philanthropic. They should be all about making money and making money for their stockholders. And that's pretty much what the law says, by the way.
Is that an
accurate characterization?
No, I think it's a little too stark. I think, our view is that corporations already do a tremendous amount of social good by providing goods and services they do. And they need to stick to doing that sort of, fulfilling that sort of role. They're not backup governments.
Right, well, the bottom line is, only you put a friendlier patina on it. I could have just as easily said corporations should be making money by providing goods and services that we all want.
Yeah.
And, so we're in agreement on that.
Yeah.
Now, but here's the problem. Because of things like the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, CAFTA, where corporations actually sit on the governing boards of these organizations, these multinational organizations, and they and because there are treaties involved with the United States that brought these organizations into existence, these corporations have the power to literally invalidate laws passed by you and me, by the voters of this country. And in fact, it's happened on numerous occasions. These corporations that you hold in such high esteem are taking the role of quasi-governments already. And they've already done this with regard to our trade policy.
Let's not put words in my mouth.
Okay. Well,
we hold the ideal of businesses in esteem. The reality is often not a pretty picture. And I agree with you that corporations do often circumvent laws that have been made by the citizens, and we oppose that.
No, I'm not talking about circumventing laws. I'm talking about actually changing laws.
Well, right. Well, we could say the same thing right now about global warming. Okay, you've got Goldman Sachs, GE, and a number of other corporations, actively lobbying to change the law for a variety of reasons, none of which are in the interest of consumers, the economy, shareholders, or anybody else.
You mean they're actively lobbying to stop global warming, and you consider that not to be in the interest
No, they're lobbying.
You're not buying my premise that global warming is real.
Well, says you.
So, yeah, right. Okay.
You,
well, but Steve, the bigger picture here, Steve Malloy with Competitive Enterprise and with Free Enterprise Action Fund.com, the bigger picture here, and this is one I think that really you and I and all people who, all thoughtful people really need to be considering, is in a world where corporations are replacing governments very quickly, and certainly where we have people running the United States government who believe that corporations should replace government. We have the privatizing of the army now. The second largest army in Iraq, for example, is private corporations, both in terms of combat and certainly in terms of support functions that traditionally were done by the army, like running the PX and doing kitchen duty and whatnot, delivering the mail. Halliburton's doing that now for the army. All these kinds of things. So as the functions that have traditionally been done by we the people, by government, are being replaced by corporate activity, and as corporations are taking on the power through these multilateral trade agreements to tell us, for example, when we passed laws that said tuna has to be dolphin safe to be sold in the United States, and after NAFTA, corporations sitting on the Chapter 11 boards of NAFTA ruled that was a violation of the treaty that we signed that created NAFTA. It was a violation of fair trade, of international trade, free trade, rather, and that because Mexico's tuna was not dolphin safe and ours was, that we were blocking the import of the... And so, therefore, a law that the Humane Society of the United States lobbied for 25 years to pass was passed with the majority support of Americans, had to be repealed, even though we wanted it, even though we passed it, because a corporation said, you've got to repeal this law. With corporations taking this much power, how can we have any sort of functioning future in this world if they don't also take on some sort of social responsibility? Now, this is not the direction that I think we should go, by the way, but you're arguing against them even being socially responsible.
Look, what we're arguing for is businesses should just do what they do best, provide goods and services, and leave the rest to duly elected or democratically elected governments. That's all we're saying. We don't see corporations taking over the role of government, although the role of government should probably shrink. Everyone needs to just stick with what they do best. Governments in setting up the rules of the game and enforcing those rules, corporations creating wealth for society, and charities, taking care of the cracks in society.
So do you think, for example, Social Security, you think this should be privately done, or this should be...
No, I think people should have ownership interest in their Social Security, which they don't.
In other words, it should not be a government project. This should be privatized.
People should own their Social Security. The money that's taken out of the check, they should own.
Well, if we are all shareholders in the United States of America, if we own this country, we do own our Social Security, Steve.
No, you really don't, because you can't pass it down. All the money, you could die when you're, age
64. I'm passing down a functioning society. That's part of the, social contract.
Social Security, Medicare, all these entitlements, we're getting off far afield from the topic. They're just going to eat up the federal budget, and we're not going to be able to. They're Ponzi schemes.
But what if they are?
Ponzi schemes.
But this is the federal budget.
Unsustainable.
We have decided that this is part of the functions of government that we want to have. We don't want corporations.
Oh, I don't know.
Corporations will be skimming money off the top and making out like bandits.
I don't know that we've decided. We've kind of inherited this system. It's been in the
It was decided by we the people. Might not like it, but guys were voted into office. Franklin Roosevelt was reelected four times.
Okay, but I didn't vote for Franklin Roosevelt. What I'd like to do is have the opportunity to vote on a revamping of the system. Okay.
So in the famous words of
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
You agree with Mr. Limbaugh, I take it.
Well, I think that, you know, we're going to have to fix Social Security and Medicare and all the entitlements because they're just going to swallow up the federal budget. They're already 60%.
And you're going to continue doing everything you can to stop any corporation from doing anything that might slow down global warming, whether or not it exists. Or
well, if it doesn't exist, they don't have to do anything now, do they?
If you're willing to take that chance with your children's future, fine. I'm not.
Well, I can look at the physics and tell you whether global warming is happening, whether anything can be done about it. You know, that's not a difficult exercise.
Tell that to the people in Biloxi. Steve Malloy, Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, FreeEnterpriseActionFund.com. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Bye-bye.
Good conversation. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. No, I'm certain it's not. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Hey, you, would you help me to carry the stone? Open your heart, I'm coming home.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Back in 1970, Milton Friedman wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine that really defined the whole Chicago School of Economics idea of what a corporation is and what it's all about. And he suggested that basically the social responsibility of business is simply to make money, and that businesses should not be socially responsible organizations. They shouldn't be making contributions. They shouldn't be making donations. And, you know, I have to say, in the context of the point of business is to make money, I find it hard to disagree with that. However, here's the problem. We have now given corporations more than simply the right to make money. We have given them the right to influence legislation. At one time in the United States, that was a crime. We have given them the right to buy legislators, to donate to legislators. At one time in the United States, that was a crime. We have given them the right to change the laws of sovereign nations. For hundreds of years, that was impossible. We have given corporations so much of our governance. And now, ever since Reagan came into office and began the process of turning the normal functions of government, the normal things that we, the people, would do for ourselves without skimming money off the top so that we can hand profits off to shareholders, but holding on to those profits and reinvesting them in our infrastructure, in our roads, in our schools, in our traffic systems, in our air traffic system, in our railroads, in our food supply, since we began privatizing these things and skimming the cream off the top and giving them to corporations, what we have ended up with is corporations that have become more than they should be. Now, you could argue, and it was argued back in the 70s, and it is still to this day, that a corporation doing a social good is a desirable thing if that social good returns a profit to the corporation. And this is generally how corporate philanthropy is done. For example, a corporation will, you know, buy a park, and the park gets named after them. And so they put $100,000 into the park, and they, you know, take a tax deduction on it, but they justify it to their board of directors by saying, $100,000, because our name's on that park, we're going to sell enough product to make that $100,000 back in profits plus more. That's traditionally how corporations have to justify this. And this goes back to a Supreme Court ruling back in, as I recall, the 1930s in the state of Michigan that involved the Ford Motor Company. And, in fact, Henry Ford was being sued over, you know, over social philanthropy, right, raising wages to his employees. How dare he do that, right? He's just screwing it up for the rest of the auto manufacturers. So, anyhow, Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, their theory is corporations should just make money. And if that's all corporations did, I'd say, yeah. But the problem is that we have given corporations personhood. We have given and they should not have personhood. We have given them the rights of persons. They should not have the rights of persons. We've given them First Amendment right to lie. We've given them the Fourth Amendment right of privacy. We've given them the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and not incriminate themselves and all the other protections associated with the Fifth Amendment, you know, against double jeopardy and so on. We've given them Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments rights to trials by jury and so on, the ability to litigate endlessly, it seems. And, you know, some of these arguably corporations should have the right to a trial, arguably. But I think that corporations are created by government. This is the thing that we keep forgetting. Corporations are creatures of us, of society. We, society, we collectively get together and we say we are going to establish the right of a corporation to exist. And we do this. You know, if you want to start a corporation, you have to go to the local Secretary of State's office and file articles of incorporation. We do this at the state level. The word corporation does not exist in the Constitution, and that's why there are only a small handful of federal corporations, federally chartered corporations, because to create a corporation at the federal level literally requires an act of Congress. So Amtrak and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, before they were turned private, federally chartered corporations, you know, there's a few federally chartered corporations, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve Banks. But by and large, corporations are created and chartered at the state level, and the deal, the compact, the contract that we create with people who start corporations, and I'm speaking as one of them, right, is you're welcome to run a corporation and make money in our society. You're welcome to use us as consumers and sell your product. In fact, we think that would be a great thing if you've got something good to sell us. But the day your activity begins being toxic to we the people, we reserve the right to put an end to the existence of your corporation. And in fact, corporations were routinely subject to the corporate death penalty up until the 1880s in the United States. And thousands a year in states all across the United States for not behaving in ways that were serving society. So you have to behave in a way that at least, at the very least, doesn't harm society and make money. And we have lost track of that. This whole the whole Friedman Chicago School sets aside that notion. It is anti-historical. It doesn't take into consideration the history of corporations, going all the way back to the Boston Tea Party when we first rose up as a people and said, no, we're not going to put up with Walmart-like behavior. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war. Bob and Eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue long will land in Kansas heart. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. I stack overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still there. Chasing ghosts and thin dry air. Meanwhile, back at home, the finest company took his car. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Shelby over at radiopower.org writes, my building was struck by lightning during a storm that suddenly rolled in around 10 p.m. last night. Pretty freaky experience. I could actually hear and feel the pulsing of electricity. Wiped out computers, servers, 10 drives, archive files, mixer controls, and started a small electrical fire. I'm in the process of determining what's lost and what can be saved. I've managed to take apart a server and 3 fried desktop computers and use the parts to get Radio Power's main server back online. Station will limp along like this for the next few weeks. But without emergency fundraising of $5,000, we won't last very long. So people, if you're listening to our program on RadioPower.org or anyway, and you support RadioPower.org, go to their website, www.radiopower.org/donations, and you can help them out. So sorry to hear about that, Shelby, and you know, hope things work out well for you. Welcome back to the program. And we've been talking about, oh, by the way, for those of you who, you know, light a candle, say a prayer, send good vibes, whatever, on Saturday, I'm going to need it. 8 o'clock Eastern time, 5 o'clock Pacific time. Looks like I'm going to be on Heartland with John Kasich on Fox TV. So debating some conservative on some issue, and we'll see what comes of that. But anyway, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Brett in Spartansburg, South Carolina. Hey, Brett, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm just great, but I'll get better, Brett. What's up?
All right. Let me tell you, you got the best radio program on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I wish Sirius would have you on 3 hours straight.
Well, we're very grateful to Dave Gorab and the folks at Sirius for the hour that we are on live, and then the other 2 hours broadcast a little bit later on in the day, but we're... You know, we're pleased to be on here. So what's up, Brett?
I just want to say that, you know, all those people that work at Walmart and get the help from the government, that's not social welfare like this fellow's talking about. That's corporate welfare.
We're right. It's allowing
Walmart rent.
It's allowing Walmart to do business because you and I are picking up the tab for the health care for their employees. Is that your point?
That's the point.
Yeah.
And every company likes them, too, as well.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree with you, Brett. I absolutely agree with you. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Jay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I haven't been listening to you guys for a little while. I need to take a break from all the baloney going on. But the Libby leak, or revelation, I know I don't have to explain to you and your listeners what that entails. And I'm just wondering if anyone out there from the right has said anything that makes any sense whatsoever to mitigate that.
No.
So how is he still in office? The cat's out of the bag. How come this isn't being dealt with properly?
Because the Republicans are in control of the House and Senate, and they refuse to allow any sort of investigation. And what most Americans, I think, don't realize is that the party in power in the House or the Senate is the only party that has the power to enforce a subpoena. That is, to compel testimony from a witness. And so the Democrats are not allowed to hold hearings, and the Republicans aren't going to.
I grant it from an official point of view, a formal point of view, that's the case. But what about just the press and the average Joe, but the press in particular, when they're standing there in front of him or McClellan and say, look, the emperor has no clothes, the cat's out of the bag, you have no credibility, and you can pretend all you want otherwise, but the jig is up. And I mean,
yeah.
It takes the press to force that issue and to treat him with hostile contempt.
Well, this is a press that is owned by large multinational corporations who, at least one of them, certainly NBC, all of their, you know, conglomerates are major in the defense industry and nuclear weapons manufacturing, or nuclear power manufacturing, rather. And we also have a situation where the members of the White House press corps have achieved a status in television that didn't exist in the day of Walter Cronkite. I mean, literally back in the day of Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, those guys, they were making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, or maybe the equivalent in today's money of $100,000 a year at the most. I mean, it was not a highly paid job. It was a high status job, but it wasn't a high paid job. And now these guys, you know, some of them are making millions of dollars a year being on TV, and they know that the day that they ask a hard question at the White House is the last day that the White House will take their question, which means that's the last time that their network is going to find them to be of any value, and therefore they don't ask the hard questions. So it's a combination of the corporate pressure from the top down, like MSNBC dumping Phil Donahue, even though he was the only profitable show on the entire network and the most profitable show, more profitable than any show they ever had, including Hardball, dumping him because of his anti-war positions, and the star syndrome that's going on that keeps these guys from asking serious questions, this confluence, and it's really, frankly, all the result of Ronald Reagan stopped in the 1980s enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, which allowed corporations to get bigger and bigger and bigger and more powerful, number one. And number two, Bill Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act of 96, combined with Reagan's deregulation the limited deregulation of the broadcast and media industries, so that we now have these we're now in the infotainment business. I remember the day when CBS spun off, you know, said, okay, our news division is now part of our entertainment division. That was something that back when I started out in radio in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, as a reporter, I started as a reporter actually in 72, it would have been unthinkable. Unthinkable. So, anyway, we'll see where this goes. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. A few quick points. First of all, I wanted to agree with the caller you had before where he says, you know, you have an amazing show. I just want to tell you, it's like listening to a scholar. So, putting that aside. You're welcome.
You keep in mind, we have to hope nobody in management is listening because that's death in radio. You're supposed to say, it's incredibly entertaining.
The gentleman that you had on the show from the Enterprise Institute, you know, in regards to privatization of Social Security, it's interesting because many countries like Chile and England have attempted those systems and they failed at it. And it's the high amounts of cost due to the overhead in the system. And also, you know, we have to remember we privatize things. Corporations look at minimizing costs, maximizing profits.
Sure.
And
that's their job.
Yeah, so they have no interest. They, you know, corporations are becoming stateless. I'm sorry, Tom.
Oh, that's
I'm
okay.
going to have to let it go there because my daughter.
Okay, I understand, Patricia. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. No, you're absolutely right, Patricia, and you make a very, very good point. I appreciate it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Great to talk to you again. You know, thank God for the Helen Thomases of the world. You know, the desperation of the media, those media conglomerates that you were mentioning, and the Bush administration is just unbelievable. I mean, the phony trials of Moussaoui and Hussein, I mean, proves how, on various levels, how phony this war on terror really is.
Well, both of these guys are bad guys.
Well, they are.
I mean, you're not disputing that.
But the fact that the media conglomerates are using this to manipulate, especially the people that have supported Bush up to this point, and they haven't been able to use their intellect to connect the dots and to see what a fascist group of killers these are.
Mm-hmm.
And they say in public, oh, this is a war on terror, but then in private, this is a war on Satan because of the way that they've sold this invasion, this illegal invasion of Iraq.
Well, Bush clearly thinks that he's opposing evil. I mean, he's decided what's evil, and he's going to kill people to solve that problem. And he does so in a fashion that, for my taste, is frankly just far too cavalier. You go back and you look at when he was governor of Texas, he bragged about the fact that he never spent more than 20 minutes reviewing a death penalty case. He executed more people, he signed more death warrants than any other governor in the history of the United States. And we have a long history, and a lot of people have been put to death. That's an incredible record to have. And never spent more than 20 minutes on any of them. And Alberto Gonzalez prepared the records for him to evaluate, so he never looked at anything that was more than a page or two. And Gonzalez prepared the summaries, and Gonzalez never raised any questions on any of these people. And we know from you know, the experience of every other state of the union that particularly when you're cranking them out like that, I mean, you know, 130-some-odd people over a period of a few years, that there's going to be at least a few where you want to go back and say, hey, are you really sure about this? And they're coming to light now. And, you know, ordering a war, I mean, this general who just said this the other day, that this is being done with a cavalier attitude, with the ease and comfort or whatever the phrase was, that you only see among people who have never had to serve and have never had to bury the results of these kinds of policy decisions. And that's what we're seeing. And then you get things like Bush coming out saying,
we found the weapons of mass destruction. You know, we found biological laboratories. But for those who say we haven't found the banned manufacturing devices or banned weapons, they're wrong. We found them.
Yeah, right. And thanks to Stop Vote Pirates over at HartmanWatch blogspot.com who tracked down the audio for us. George W. Bush saying, yeah, we found it, 2 days after the White House gets a report saying, nah, sorry, it's for weather balloons. But what's even more bizarre is that 4 months later, Dick Cheney is still saying the same thing. I mean, these guys, it's like, you know, honesty, truth, nah, doesn't matter. Just roll it out. Just as long as Halliburton is making money, we'll have a war. We can privatize Social Security. George W. Bush saying that he was going to have a war back in 1999. He was going to have a war with Iraq so he could get his agenda through. His agenda? Roll back the New Deal.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, destroy America. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs. Here that hide behind walls. Here that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks.
And welcome back, my friends, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Tom Hartman here with you. A couple of people have called in and said, what's that TV show you're going to be on? On Saturday, it's 5 o'clock Pacific, 8 o'clock Eastern time, The Heartland with John Kasich. I think I'm pronouncing it right. I'm not familiar with the program, frankly, but I will be after Saturday. John was a member of Congress for 18 years, and he substitutes his host for Bill O'Reilly, apparently. So, according to his bio over at Fox News. So, it's on your whatever your Fox News channel is, if you're curious.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, Tom DeLay, United Press International, is now reporting that among the candidates to replace Josh Bolten as the director of the Office of Management and Budget, the group that, you know, inside the government that puts together the annual budget on behalf of the administration. Among that bunch, the short list of candidates, former Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Yes, indeed. It's just, I'm sorry, it just cracks me up. I guess, as the administration's, somebody in the administration made the comment, no one knows more about the budget. And, yeah. So our DeLay political death, Tom DeLay, the gift that keeps on giving. There's just no other way of saying it. Leanne in Lubbock, Texas. Hey, Leanne, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Oh, yes, I'm on, right?
You are.
I was just wanting to comment that I really appreciate your show, and I listen as often as I can. But
thank you.
On the topic of corporate profit and that being an appropriate motivation and the only thing business should do,
mm-hmm.
I have a thought about that, and that is that I think that going for profit only is in and of itself corrupting.
Sure.
That having profit as a means to some other goal is maybe something we should be looking for instead.
Well, this is, I mean, historically, this has been the way that we've looked at it in the United States. We've said you can make a profit as long as you're doing something that is useful, you know, not destructive, not toxic, you're not poisoning people, you're not killing people, and you're doing it in a way that is socially responsible. It doesn't mean that we're expecting you to fulfill the functions of government, but that you're doing it. And now the problem is that the imperative to increase profits is to internalize profits and externalize costs. And so for many companies, what this means is dumping, for example, their toxic waste, which it would be costly to appropriately dispose of, into the commons for the rest of us to pay for. For example, you know, right now, all these Superfund sites, under the Bush administration, no longer are the polluters paying into the Superfund. So they're not paying to clean up their own pollution. You and I are. It's all being thrown on the American taxpayer. And that's just wrong. There's just an enormous amount of corporate welfare out there, and Bush really turned this into a fine art in Texas, and this is why Texas is now one of the most heavily polluted states in the United States, by making all of the, not all, but the vast majority of the pollution controls voluntary rather than mandatory to the extent that he could. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why government regulation, in the absence of government regulation, what we will end up with is a corporatocracy that will be so toxic that ultimately itself will fail, because it will either become oppressive and fascistic, you know, an unholy alliance with government, mm-hmm. or the people will rise up and say, enough already. I mean, we have a situation in the news today. Here's this article out of China, 200 from Reuters. 200 Chinese villagers, angry over pollution of their water supply, attacked three factories and a sewage treatment plant, a Hong Kong newspaper said on Wednesday. Villagers in the eastern province of Fujian, armed with iron bars, smashed windows and appliances on Saturday at the sewage plant, two leather factories, and a South Korean-invested plastics factory. They rushed into the office building, kitchen, dormitory, and grocery store, smashed all the glass, air conditioners, and other breakable things, and took anything valuable, including kitchen items. The paper quoted the owner of the Zindi Leather Company in Jiangsu as saying, three cars were also destroyed, he said. Police and local officials broke up the protest. What are they protesting? Protests against polluting industries are common now across China's countryside. I'm still reading from Reuters, where the environment has all too often been sacrificed in the pursuit of profits. Outright attacks are less widely reported. Villagers had complained that discharge from the sewage treatment plant about half a mile from their homes had polluted the water supply, damaged crops, and created a lingering stench, the newspaper said. So that's the consequence. Leanne, your point is spot on, and I appreciate your calling and making it. Thank you very much. It's well said. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Real quick here. Today's Jefferson's birthday, right?
That's right. In fact, I'm going to be sharing with you some stories about Jefferson later on in the program from my book, What Would Jefferson Do?
Okay. Yeah, I got that book. Great book. Well, first, thank you for doing FDR yesterday. I love his speeches. And also on this Jefferson, obviously the cons keep trying to co-opt Jefferson to convince us all that he was a conservative Republican. You know,
yeah, we've got
right?
George Allen now running around
exactly.
saying that he's a Jeffersonian Republican.
Exactly.
And that's like saying I'm a dog that meows.
And here I'm looking at a site called the Jefferson. It's the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College. Mr. Jefferson goes to the Middle East, and it's a whole conference for cons. And they got books here, Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I mean, they keep trying to do it, man.
Yeah, well, the reality is that Thomas Jefferson said he was an advocate of a limited federal government. And so, you know, the cons grab that and say, well, this is what it's all about.
Capitalism are not the same.
That's right, exactly. Well said. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. It's just, yes, democracy and capitalism are not the same thing. And Jefferson would have been the first to point it out. In fact, he wanted there to be an 11th Amendment to the Constitution. Actually, he wanted to combine the 6th and 7th, so there'd still be 10, because that was a magic number, that banned monopolies in commerce. He wrote letters to Madison all over the place about this. Didn't work, though. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson: the man who reads nothing at all is better educated than the man who reads nothing but newspapers. It must have been a bad day for old Tom. Oh, my. Although, increasingly, in the world of corporate-owned media, you have to scratch your head and say, you know, how is it that so many people believe so many myths? For example, the myth that, you know, in America it's the land of opportunity. Anybody can grow up to be a millionaire. This is the place of all the countries in the world where if you're born poor, you're most likely to end up rich. I would say most Americans believe that to be true. David Smith is with us. He's with Demos. Is it, how do you pronounce
it? Demos, Tom.
Demos.
D-E-M-O-S and pronounced Demos.
As in the Greek.
As in the Greek.
D-E-M-O-S.org, the website. Demos has published a new book. It's an anthology called Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. David, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Blow apart this myth. What is the percentage of Americans who have who born into poverty, who have the ability to escape from poverty, or who succeed in doing that on an annual basis in the United States versus other countries? Where are we in that ranking?
Well, it's very small here, Tom. If you're born into the poorest 20% of the population, if household income of your folks is in the poorest 20%, the chances are almost 50%. that when you're an adult, you'll be in the lowest 20% of the income distribution, and only 20% that you'll be in the top 20% of the income distribution. So there isn't very much mobility. Household income is the parents' household income is the best predictor of your household income during your own adulthood.
Well, and in fact, there's a chart in your book titled Annual Percentage of Poor People Escaping Poverty. So, you know, because sometimes we do numbers to the point where people just kind of go into number wonk overload, you know. But
right.
But in Denmark, 60% of people born into poverty, 6 out of 10 people born into poverty, actually escape poverty during their life.
Well, that's right. And the number's even more important because it's a very small percentage of Danes born into poverty.
Right. Okay, so 60% of Danes escape poverty, 58.8%, roughly 60% of people in the UK, 55.7% in the Netherlands, 54.6% in Ireland. I'll just use the round numbers. 49 or 50% in Spain, 48% in Belgium, 46% in France, 41% in Germany, 40% in Italy. And then we get to the United States. 29.5%. Fewer than a third of people born into poverty in the United States ever make it out of poverty. Why? What is so different between the United States and Denmark, the UK, the Netherlands, Ireland, Spain, Belgium? What's so different between us and them that people born into the United States stay in poverty and they don't in these other countries?
Well, I think that there are two that are worth talking about, many, but two that are worth emphasizing. One is the social institutions, the access to public education of a universal high quality, access to health care that allows you to maintain yourself in shape to go to work, access to decent retirement. All of those things exist to a greater extent in most of the European Union than do here. The minimum wage here is shockingly low. We haven't increased it since 1997. It's now at its lowest real value since it was established.
Now let me just, if I could just interrupt you here for a moment, David Smith, with Demos.org. What you're describing are, you know, I have conservatives on this program regularly, and they come on and they say, you know, I'll go through these things that you just listed, and they go, oh, but that's socialism. You know, that's not in the Constitution. That's income redistribution. You're talking like Karl Marx. And the fact of the matter is that these countries are all democracies. Their people voted to have this. It was not imposed on them to have these kind of social safety net systems and these kind of social structures. They pay their taxes. I don't want to say enthusiastically, but they view it as investments in the infrastructure and in the future of their nation. And somehow we have disconnected from that in this country.
Well, I think there's another important thing to remember here, Tom, is that inequality also infects our political process. You know, campaigns are enormously expensive. Only a tiny fraction of us can afford to and do contribute the maximum allowed by law. I think it's about 0.1% now in each election cycle make the maximum contribution to a candidate running for office.
Which is $2,000 now, right?
This is $2,000, $2,100 now because it's been indexed. But the political outcomes reflect the folks who pay for our political process. We have a tiny fraction of folks supporting candidates. Men and women who want to run for public office spend an enormous amount of time with a tiny sliver of the population. And it shouldn't surprise us that the political outcomes of a process that's financed that way reflect the interests of those who pay for it.
But it wasn't always this way. I mean, during Roosevelt's administration, during Truman's administration, even arguably during Eisenhower's administration, we had a strong and growing and relatively vibrant middle class. There's another chart in the book, share of total income received by the top 5% and bottom 40%. And, you know, these two numbers relatively track each other until we hit 1982, first year of the Reagan administration. And then they begin to diverge in what could only be, it's like two magnets pulling away from each other. The top 5% income explodes and the bottom 40% wealth collapses.
No, that's right. And you look, no matter which set of numbers you look at income numbers, at wealth numbers, the explosion in divergence has been enormous over the last 25 or 30 years. You know, it's important to remember that one of the great triumphs of the American democracy was building that middle class. Building a middle class with institutions like the GI Bill, which allowed literally millions of young men to be the first folks in their families to go on to college. Union membership was at 30% of the industrial workforce. Those union jobs allowed more buoyancy in that middle class. We built middle class suburbs. And then it began to erode. It began to erode for a couple of important reasons that are entirely in our hands. Probably the single most important event of the first year of the Reagan first term was firing the air traffic controllers.
Right. Declaring war on
Declaring war on organized labor. That would have been unthinkable in 1970 or 1960 by any president or any president of a large corporation. Reagan made it okay, and the attack on unions escalated through the 80s and into the early 90s and resumed itself again at the beginning of this century.
So now we have a situation where Americans and the American media have so bought into this BS and are so cowed somehow that George W. Bush can come out and in a public speech, and he repeated this many times, can come out in a public speech and say, let's give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires to the tune of $500,000 for each job that they create. In other words, we're going to give somebody $500,000, and they will create one job with that, and that will be a good thing. Here's the clip of Bush saying this, and it's just, I mean...
With a robust package of at least $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
And you divide a million into $550 billion, you get $550,000 per job. And nobody in the media pointed that out. Nobody in the newspapers pointed that out. Nobody asked him about that. The Democrats didn't jump down his throat on it. Why?
Well, a couple of reasons. I mean, one, we have bought into the myth that this somehow God does this. This is the inevitable magic hand, unseen hand of the market working its will. Obviously, that's not true. When we decided we were going to have inequality-reducing policies after the Second World War, we succeeded. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, every decade, income growth was higher at the bottom than at the top, and the middle rose. You know, one of the ironies are... Then along came Reagan. And one of the little-known facts about the three Bush tax cuts, the third one that they're trying to make permanent now, is that for the first time since the income tax was adopted in the early part of the 20th century, after-tax income will be even more unequally distributed than before-tax income. That's an extraordinary transformation in public policy.
It truly is, and it's an ongoing, and there's almost this mythos of, well, let's treat unearned income differently than earned income, because
it's not a mythos, it's a fact. We do treat it differently.
Oh, I know we do, but the mythos is that we should do it because it is somehow qualitatively different.
Right.
That people who earn their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive are somehow engaged in a more noble occupation than somebody who's digging a ditch.
No, you're absolutely right.
It's mind-boggling.
But let me go back to something you said.
David Smith, we got to take a break here. David, can you stick around for a few minutes?
I sure can.
We're talking with David Smith, the organization demos.org, and we'll be back in just a minute. 16 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
George Bush, don't lie. George Bush, don't lie. George Bush, don't lie.
Hey, welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. And not the most melodic bumper music I've ever heard, but I guess, you know, the point is made. The fading American dream The state of working America, the whole overview of this thing is the subject of a marvelous new collection of articles, I guess you could say, organized in a very thoughtful and comprehensive fashion. Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences, a book by Demos, demos.org, D-E-M-O-S, talking with David Smith, who helped put this book together. David, it seems like the bottom line here is really a very simple one, and that is that if you want to have social mobility, economic mobility in society, the probability, a greater probability that people can become entrepreneurs, that they can move from poverty into the middle class, then there has to be a government structure that enables that, a social safety net, a superstructure, which includes, you know, fundamental things like minimum wage, the right to unionize, strong unions, national health care, some job security, some protection for laborers, and a financial system that has some integrity, you know, that doesn't get tampered with. And yet these are the things that have been under assault literally since the day Ronald Reagan came into office. And frankly, I'd say even during the Clinton administration, it was more of a pause than a reversal. And we have now a generation, at least, maybe two, of people who think that the Republican way, the Reagan way, is how it should be. What do we do about that?
Well, you know, I think the American people, Tom, are certainly ahead of the American political leadership on this one. Yesterday, the state of Maine agreed to raise its minimum wage to $7 an hour. That's $1.85 more than the federal minimum wage.
Right.
That means that over half of all American workers now live in either cities or states with a higher than federal minimum wage. So people are saying, come on, there's something fundamentally wrong here, and if the feds won't change it, we'll take it into our own hands. And we all saw this weekend and on Monday an extraordinary outpouring of support for immigrant workers who are among the lowest paid, the least mobile, most abused in the society. Hundreds of thousands of people all over the country said, enough, we're tired of this. So I'm encouraged by some of what's going on out there. It's discouraging when you look at the numbers, you think about the last 20 years, but the American people aren't stupid, and they're figuring this out.
Don't you think, though, I don't want to make this segment about immigration, but to a certain extent, don't you think that the American people are also figuring out that unlimited immigration is exactly what multinational corporations want because it dilutes the labor force to the point where unionization is impossible?
Well, it's not so much unlimited immigration. I don't think anybody's for unlimited immigration. Nobody I've ever talked to in the immigrant community or anywhere else is. But
I've talked to a number of them who are. Let's do away with borders.
What they are saying is that if we don't assure that immigrant workers are protected by OSHA, protected by the Wage and Hour Administration at the Labor Department, they are easy to exploit. They're enormously vulnerable to being turned into the INS, and that has an impact on everybody's wages.
That in and of itself is depressing wages just as much or perhaps even more than the simple presence of more people in the labor pool.
That's absolutely right.
So, broadly speaking, I mean, first of all, is the premise that I laid out when we first came back from the break, in your mind, wholly accurate? That really it's just that simple. There's a half a dozen basic programs that Truman helped, for example, Germany and Japan write into their constitutions after World War II that built them into powerful economic powers that conservatives have been fighting forever? Or is there more to it? Is there something I'm missing?
Well, I thought you laid it out very well. Just think for a minute. In 1955, 30% of elderly households in the United States were living in poverty. Today, the number is under 10%. What's the reason? The reason is real simple. It's Social Security and the decision to index Social Security benefits to the cost of living, and Medicare, which now pays just about half the health care bills of older citizens. Without that 30% number would have persisted. Whether it's retirement issues, workplace fairness issues, you need a government that's on the side of everyday ordinary people, and we haven't had one in this country for some time.
So how do you respond when somebody says to you, but that's socialism? We have just 1 minute here, David.
I don't think anybody believes that the legacy of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight D. Eisenhower is socialism.
I'll tell you, half the Republicans in Congress do.
Well,
talk
half
to
the
them.
Republicans, you know, that's right. And it's important to remember that we have got a Congress now which is bought and paid for by a narrow chunk of the American population. 400 out of the 435 sitting members will face no serious opposition when they run for re-election this fall. The democracy is as distorted as our economic justice system.
So we have both the problem, the structural problems in our economic system, as well as campaign finance reform and these kinds of things, or public financing of campaigns.
Public financing is probably the right and only answer that will really make a difference.
Well said. David Smith with Demos.org, D-E-M-O-S.org. The book, Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. Check it out. David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tommy.
Great talking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. A true people's radio. You're smack dab in the vast liberal conspiracy, my friends. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, and EcoWine, 1-888-ECOWINE, the organic wine company. And for those people who were wondering, I was just raving about one of their wines yesterday. And no, it was not a paid commercial endorsement. It was actually, I really was blown away by this stuff. It's the, and we got so many emails from people, I'm just going to say it on the air again, and that'll be it. It's the Mazdejanini, Mazdejanini, Syrah, Syrah, 2002. So my guess is if you just ask for that 2002 Syrah, they would know what you're talking about. But odds are if you call the organic wine company at 1-888-ECO-WINE, they won't have a clue because they didn't ask me to say this. I just tried that stuff out. And I was like, this is an incredible wine. Every now and then, you know, it was just, it was so good that Louise had to go upstairs and just was compelled and get some blue cheese and crackers to have with it. It was like, we've got to eat with this stuff. This is, rather than just sitting here with a glass of wine. Oh, my. Okay. From the entertaining to the, or the, you know, from food to, from life to death, let's say. Yeah, wine is a living food. It's raw food, actually. It's one of the nice things if you're on a raw food diet. In any case, Iran is, the demonization of Iran, which is not to say that Iran may not represent problems, shall we say. But this ongoing demonization of Iran is getting really and truly bizarre. There is a headline that Bloomberg News, of course, the news organization owned by billionaire Michael Bloomberg, the Republican mayor of New York City, who spent $70 a vote to get elected his first time around. Why not just give people the money? I remember when I was in Russia, I was in Kaliningrad, the year of the very first election in Russia. And, you know, when Yeltsin was running and I was staying with a Russian family, and the wife was German-Russian, and the husband was Russian-Russian, and he only spoke Russian. She spoke German and Russian, and I speak English and German. And so I would talk with her in German. And, you know, so we're sitting around in the living room watching TV in Russian. And it's the election campaign. And this guy comes on. And he's got this wild-eyed look in his face. He looked like Zell Miller. He's got this wild-eyed look in his face, and he's pounding his fist on the table and pointing at the screen and, you know, rah, 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 waving his hands around. And all of a sudden, the woman, the wife, breaks out into laughter, and the husband has this perplexed look on his face. And I don't speak, you know, I know a few words in Russian, a few phrases, but I certainly couldn't follow what this guy was saying. And So, and then they flash, and then he finishes, the guy on TV, he finishes his rant, and they flash to the two newscasters, and there's man and woman at one of these, plywood sets, you know, with the grape, or the orange peel planet Earth behind them, you know, the, it looked like a TV set from the 1960s. And they're having this very serious conversation, these two newscasters. And the husband is following this, and the wife is just thinks this is the most hysterical thing she's ever seen. And so I said to her, you know, Vasistas, what's going on? What's this all about? And she says, oh, that was Vladimir Zhirinovsky. Now, Vladimir Zhirinovsky is the right-wing extremist, nationalist, Silvio Berlusconi, George Bush, a right-wing wacko candidate who is running and took about, well, actually, he's more like Pat Buchanan, I guess. And he took something like 20% of the vote, actually. And she said, and he just said that if you vote for me, I will give you a bottle of vodka and a turkey. And the commentators now are trying to figure out where he's going to find that many turkeys in the Soviet Union. Is he going to have to import them from the European Union? In other words, they're taking this seriously. And like her husband is like taking it seriously. And she's just cracked up. I mean, you know, she spent part of her life in Germany and she, you know, knows how democracies work. And she just thinks this is the most absurd thing she's ever seen. And really, it was tragic. So anyhow, I tell that story by way of this is the bizarre demonizing that is going on. It's almost like we're being told these kinds of stories. I mean, well, back to Bloomberg, you know, I said $70 a vote. Why doesn't he just tell everybody, hey, vote for me, I'll give you a bottle of vodka and a turkey, or $70. Would have worked better. Anyhow, Bloomberg's news service ran a story today with a headline, and this headline was on Drudge, probably still is, and millions and millions of Americans are reading this, and it's being reported, and it's all over the right-wing websites. This headline says, Iran could produce nuclear bomb in 16 days, U.S. says. Now, you read that headline, and most people just read headlines, and you think, holy cow, Iran is 16 days away from a nuclear bomb. We better bomb them now. And in fact, the first paragraph, Iran, defying United Nations Security Council demands to halt its nuclear program, may be capable of making a nuclear bomb within 16 days, a U.S. State Department official said. Say what? Now, you read the article about this, you know, bomb in 16 days. And you look at, you know, who is it who said this? It's a guy named Stephen Rademacher, Stephen G. Rademacher. He's the Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control and Nuclear Nonproliferation. Okay, so it's his job to make sure that not too much stuff, you know, that nuclear nonproliferation is, you know, in some way, you know, reasonably held in check. And here he is, you know, coming out and saying this. Oh, I found it. And you have to ask yourself, why? Who is this guy and what is he actually saying? Now, here's what we know. What we know is that Iran has 164 centrifuges and that they use those 164 centrifuges to produce a small amount of 3.5% concentrated U-235, uranium that could be used in a nuclear reactor. Nuclear reactors require that natural uranium has such a low percentage, it's like a tenth of a percent or something, such a low percentage of what's called fissionable uranium, U-235, the uranium that will that will disintegrate quickly and will operate in a chain reaction kind of fashion. It has such a low percentage of it that it's actually quite stable. And so you put it in the centrifuge, you spin it around at supersonic speeds, and the heaviest stuff rolls to the bottom and the lighter stuff comes to the top, like happens in centrifuges. And you do it long enough, and you get the U-235 down there in the bottom, the heavy stuff, and you skim that out, and you've got concentrated uranium, right? You've got just the U-235, or what's called enriched uranium. Well, with 164 centrifuges, according to Rademacher, it would take that country 13 years. Running these centrifuges 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, day and night, it would take them 13 years to produce enough uranium for one nuclear bomb. Now, if that's the case, and that's how many centrifuges they have, why did he say that they could have a nuclear bomb in 16 days? And why is that the headline? Well, it turns out that Iran has a facility in a city called Natanz. They've got a facility where they have the potential to build 50,000 centrifuges. They don't have them. They have the potential to build them. And so Stephen Radden, and so now we get to paragraph 3 in the Bloomberg.com story. Using those 50,000 centrifuges, this is a quote, using those 50,000 centrifuges, they could produce enough highly enriched uranium for a nuclear weapon in 16 days, end of quote. Stephen Rademacher, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for International Security and Nonproliferation, told reporters today in Moscow. So he's saying, I mean, we have to figure out, you know, is he saying this to intentionally deceive us, or did Bloomberg take this wildly out of context? Because there aren't 50,000 centrifuges. In fact, what Iran is talking about, later down in the article, Iran has informed the Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency that it plans to construct 3,000 centrifuges at Natanz next year, Rademacher said. So next year they're going to build 3,000. And then he says, we calculate with a 3,000 machine cascade, they could produce enough uranium to build one nuclear weapon within 271 days. Now, how long is it going to take them to construct 3,000 centrifuges? Several years, maybe? I mean, the best guesses are they're somewhere between 5 and 11 years away from making a nuclear weapon. So why is it that Bloomberg, in the first three paragraphs, is saying that they could produce a bomb in 16 days using 50,000 centrifuges? Is this a neocon inside the Bush administration trying to whip up war? Well, it turns out Stephen Rademacher was one of the big advocates for the war in Iraq. So it would make a certain amount of sense that he's in favor of a war in Iran. But the fact of the matter is that Iran is 49,836 centrifuges short of being able to do what this headline says they could do. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Now people have died, they are right. If they won't even rest their peace of mind. Hell for profit, and no one's gonna stop it. We better wake up and fight.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. So if the Bush administration is trying to gin up a war, why? Just have to ask yourself the question, why? Why would the Bush administration be trying to gin up a war? I wrote about this on commondreams.org, and you'll find it over at truthout.org and informationclearinghouse.info and buzzflash.com and opednews.com and other places all around the web. In an article titled, Democracy Be Damned, Republicans Need Another War. And this is the thing that absolutely boggles my mind, is that on talk show after talk show after talk show, whether it's radio or television, you hear people saying, gee, why did Bush go to war in Iraq? I mean, there's actually people, you know, even conservatives. I mean, Chris Matthews asking this question of people in the last couple of days. Well, why, you know, if he knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction there, and it's pretty obvious now that he knew this, that they were just lying to us. They were cherry-picking the so-called intelligence. You know, if he knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction, why war? Was it for oil? I mean, was that the reason? Because if that was the reason, we seem to have kind of blown it. And some people thought that was. I mean, after all, there was Dick Cheney.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And George W. Bush, when he declared war, he turned to the people of Iraq and he said, now I'd like to speak to the people of Iraq.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And a lot of people all over the world at that point said, oh, that's what it's all about. But the fact of the matter is that we're pumping less oil out of Iraq now than we were before. And billions of dollars obviously has been stolen, lost, skimmed, schemed out of this thing. But, you know, I frankly don't think it's about oil. You could argue it might be about control of the Middle East and, you know, strategic oil, you know, blah, blah, blah. And now, in fact, perhaps we'll have time to get into this in the next hour. Saudi Aramco has essentially, for all practical purposes, admitted that they are now past peak oil. Their oil fields are declining at the rate of 8% per year. Bad news, unless you happen to be an investor in an oil company. But I would suggest that the reason why Bush really went to war is the most cynical and craven of all reasons. And we've, frankly, in as far as I can tell, only had one other president in the history of the United States who did this, and that was McKinley. Back just before the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, when McKinley started the Spanish-American War on the advice of his advisor, Mark Hanna, who Karl Rove has said in newspaper, radio, and magazine interviews is his role model. Mark Hanna, the first modern political handler in the 1890s, the late 1890s. That, you know, they faked the explosion on the USS Maine, or they took a boiler explosion and faked it up and said, you know, we're going to have a war for political purposes, to gain political capital. I mean, you get James Madison saw this coming on April 20th, 1795. He wrote, of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. He said, in war, too, the discretionary power of the president is extended. His influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. This same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and morals endangered by both. No nation, James Madison wrote on April 20, 1795, no nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. And I would suggest to you that freedom is the last thing George Bush wants. That if you go back and you listen to the words, Cindy Sheehan saying it very eloquently, she did it right.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
There you go. And that's from an interview that was done with Cy Hirsch, as I recall. No, it was Russ Baker, an interview with Russ Baker, who interviewed Herskowitz. And Herskowitz went on to say that Bush expressed frustration at a lifetime as an underachiever in the shadow of an accomplished father. And he said, in aggressive military action, he saw the opportunity to emerge from his father's shadow. In my opinion, the reason why we had the war in Iraq, the reason why I got ginned up just before the elections of 2002, was to help Republicans take the Senate back. And the reason why it happened in time for the 2004 election was so that George W. Bush could attempt to actually get elected. He'd been appointed in 2001, and they still had to steal a vote in Ohio. And the reason why we're in all probability possibly going to have a war, or at the very least we're going to have a lot of war rhetoric after the summer break, and they're just testing the waters right now, in my opinion, because, you know, it's summer's coming. And as I believe it was Andy Card said, you don't roll out a product during the summer. You wait until the fall season. And he was referring to the Iraq war before when he said that in 2002. So I would guess that this war is going to happen in September, October of this year. Is it going to be a war with Iran? I still think and hope, if they're not hope, but if they're going to have a war, that they take on a, you know, Syria or something. But let's hope they don't have any war at all. I mean, let's stop the Iran war now. David Swanson, in fact, has a new new website out. I believe it's called StopIranWar.org. I'll have to double check on that. But this is the most craven of reasons, to have a war for political gain. And in my opinion, that's what this is all about. That's what the Bush administration, that's why they had the war. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So we're having an economic boom, they say. Unemployment at an all-time low. The stock market is pretty solid. Inflation is under control. Everything is doing just fine. How is it that we're creating... How is it that we're creating new jobs? How is it that the Treasury Department reported Wednesday that things are going well? I mean, at least this is how the Republicans are spinning it. How is it? Where are these jobs coming from? How are people getting employed? By the way, the website that I mentioned in the last hour, don'tattackiran.org, David Swanson's new website. And, you know, if you're up for saying, hey, don't attack Iran... Makes sense. No apostrophe. Don'tattackiran.org. Well, here may be a clue to why, in the face of what you would think would cause the economy to do poorly, the economy may be at least limping along. Now, first of all, here's why I would submit to you that the economy, you would expect the economy to be doing poorly. Because conservative economic policies of increasing the wealth of the rich and decreasing the wealth of the poor and the middle class by decreasing the amount of taxes paid by the rich and the ultra-rich for their share of the usage of the commons and for their share of access to the opportunity that we call the American dream. By decreasing that and by increasing the taxes on average people and working people and the working poor, and by cutting what are called transfer services, if you want to call them that, by cutting services, cutting medical, Medicare, cutting education funding, cutting the basic infrastructures, the basic social safety net, doing away with that for the middle class and the working poor, you would think, because the vast majority of economic activity in the United States is driven by the working poor and the middle class buying things, see, that is 99% of us. You would think 98% of us, let's say 99% of us earn less than $390,000 a year. 98% of us earn less than $150,000 a year. So you would think that the vast majority of Americans, if you look at the vast majority of Americans, their spending is what drives the economy. So if you make it harder for them to have money to spend, you would think the economy would go into a tailspin. So why hasn't the economy collapsed in the face of Bush policies that have driven up the wealth of those at the very top who don't spend so much? I mean, they already have their mansions. They already have their corporate jets. Yeah, there's, you know, they might buy a new yacht. It's not really going to stimulate the economy of the United States, because it's such a small percentage of the total GDP, and it's such a small number of people, relatively speaking. We're talking a few hundred thousand people, the rich and the very rich. So if we are reducing the money for the middle class and the working poor, how is it that they're still spending money? Well, a couple of things have happened. Number one, Alan Greenspan drove interest rates down so low that the value of housing went up. Now, most people, they say they own their home. They don't actually own their home. They owe, in most cases, more than their home is worth. What they own is a mortgage to the bank. But still, say somebody bought a house for $150,000 10 years ago, and, you know, the value of a house is based on how much the payments are. people in the middle class don't think of a house in terms of, can I afford a $150,000 house? They think of it in terms of, can I afford a $450 a month house payment, mortgage payment? And so as interest rates go down, the cost of the payments on a $150,000 house goes down. Or what used to be the payments on a $150,000 house at, say, 7% mortgage rates, now is, you know, say it's, I don't have a mortgage calculator in front of me, so I'm just, you know, these are just for example numbers. But say, the house that you wanted to buy was $450 a month at 7% interest rates. When interest rates go down to 5% for $450 a month, you can now buy a house that's worth, say, $30,000 more. It's now it's $150,000. Now you can afford a $180,000 house. So what that means is the people who have $450 a month to spend are going to start looking at $180,000 houses, which means that everybody with a $150,000 house, a $450 a month house, is going to start asking $180,000 for their house, right? So the cost or the value, the perceived value of housing goes up as interest rates go down. Now, when the value of the housing goes up, then the equity that you have in your house seems to increase. And then you get all these ads on TV for all these companies, you know, Ditech.com and LendingTree and everybody else, everybody and their brother out there saying, hey, refinance your house and take out the equity. So the driving down the interest rates increases the value of housing. People then refinance their house and take out that cash and spend it. So that's a big chunk over the last 5 years of what has been keeping this economy from not completely collapsing, but from having a serious, serious problem, is the fact that housing values have gone up and credit has been easy. Now interest rates are starting to go up, and when they pass the 6 or 7% threshold, you're going to see some real significant changes. I lived through this. We saw this in the 1970s. First house I bought, we bought on it with a mortgage that was 13%. And that was, ultimately, that was low. So what that does is that drives the value of houses back down again. So when the value of houses goes down, suddenly people are holding a $150,000 mortgage and their house is now only worth $110,000. One of two things happens. Either they just walk away from it, or the bank comes to them and says, hey, you owe $150,000, it's only worth $120,000. You better pay us the $30,000 difference right now. Yes, that's in your mortgage contract. They can do that. So anyhow, that's one of the things that has fueled the economy. Secondly, people are driving up their credit card debt. Average American owes $7,000 on their credit cards. But third, and this is the most important one, how the Bush administration has been able to make the economy look good when in fact it's not, is war. War. W-A-R, war. The Treasury Department reported Wednesday that federal spending totaled $250 billion last month. That's up 13.7% from a year ago. Federal spending is 13% higher than it was a year ago. For every $100 spent a year ago, $130 was spent this year. Now, that's money from our tax dollars and money borrowed in the name of our children and grandchildren that Bush is spending right now. Where is he spending it? He's spending it in ways that indirectly and in many cases directly stimulate our economy, largely through the Department of Defense. In fact, if you go over to defenselink.mil, this is the Department of Defense's website, DOD 101, an introductory overview to the Department of Defense. Welcome to the Department of Defense. We are America's oldest company, largest company, busiest company, most successful company. Now, first of all, the Department of Defense is not a company. Government is not a business. Government is of, by, and for we the people, run by the people, answerable to the people. Somehow the cons have rewritten this thing. I mean, this is just absolutely bizarre. But they go on and they say, the Department of Defense has a budget of $371 billion and over 2 million employees. Walmart has a budget of $227 billion and employs 1.3 million people. In other words, the Department of Defense is a third again larger than Walmart, which is the largest company in America. ExxonMobil has a budget of $200 billion and employs almost 98,000 people. The GM company budget equals $180 billion and has a workforce of 365,000 people. Now, keep in mind, the Department of Defense, $371 billion budget, 2 million employees. And these are good-paying jobs. So as the Department of Defense grows, the economy grows. And the Department of Defense is growing like crazy. And the businesses associated with it are growing like crazy. So basically what we have here is an economy that without a war will collapse. And particularly without the added prop of cheap credit. Because this government's policies, because the conservative economic policies have been to reduce the amount of money available to the working class, to the middle class and the working poor, and increase the cash available to the very wealthy, which doesn't stimulate the economy. So they've had to stimulate the economy indirectly by driving down interest rates, which lets people borrow from their house and their credit cards, number one, and by pumping enormous amounts of money into the DOD budget. And that's the only thing that's holding it together, my friends. It's glue and bubblegum. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman radio program. Folks in the chat room asking me to repeat it. I apparently everybody didn't get it. Saturday, 5 p.m. Pacific time, 8 p.m. Eastern time, Heartland with John Kasich on Fox News. I will be debating Michael Smirkanish. So there you go. Fox News. 8 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Well, that's appointment TV, Tom, right there.
What, appointment TV?
It's appointment TV.
What do you mean?
Well, there's a phrase that people use. It's called appointment TV. It's there has to be something really good on TV, so you make an appointment with yourself to watch it.
Ah, okay. Oh, thank
you. And that's what this is.
I see. Well,
slice and dice, I think.
I see. Yeah, well, we'll see. It should be an entertaining conversation because Michael Smirkanish is a smart guy.
He is a smart guy, but you're an extremely smart guy.
Well,
so.
Bless you, my friend. Thank you. I appreciate it. We'll see. We'll see how it comes out. He's certainly familiar with the medium, and it's I've done it before. Anyway, it's going to be. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun. What's happening in Washington, D.C.?
The town is emptying for Easter, Passover. The president is getting ready to, in fact, he's probably already left for Camp David. Interestingly, he's not going to the ranch. He's going to Camp David.
Now, do you think that's because Cindy Sheehan's down at the ranch? I'm serious. I got a news release. I got a news release from her this morning saying, or an email from her this morning saying, we're going down to the ranch, but as soon as we announced that, George decided that he was going to go to Camp David instead, and we think that that's why.
So she ran him off. My goodness.
I think so.
That's pretty impressive stuff. He's coming back on Sunday, so he'll be back in time for the Easter egg roll. We were not able to get the confirmation in the briefing today whether he would be attending the Easter egg roll, which, of course, as you know, is open to families.
Yes, and in fact, there will be gay families there, which I understand there's quite an effort to have gay couples with their kids there.
Yes, there is a big effort by gay couples to be there and to make the point that they are families too. And when Scott was asked about this today at the White House, he really didn't say very much. I get the impression this is a controversy they want to stay well out of.
But if Bush doesn't show up and it's perceived as a slap on gay families, I mean, that... I suppose that's another polarizing thing that'll help him with his base
so.
And hurt him with everybody else.
Yeah, I think it depends on what the protocol is. If he normally goes, if it's something of the first ladies, and it is, certainly, she goes, then if she's just there, then that would be okay. If it's something that he normally does show up to and he doesn't show, then unless he's got the Premier of China, who I don't believe is due that day, it's Monday, it's a fairly quiet day, then that would certainly be controversial. But he doesn't seem to be afraid of controversy, or if he is afraid of controversy at this point, he has no choice.
Yeah.
Because it's day after day after day, the body blows keep coming.
Yeah. Now, today, Bloomberg is publishing this headline that says in 16, 18 days, something like that, the Iranians might have nuclear weapons. Turns out that this is taken out of context very badly from one of Bush's neocon aides in the State Department, who said if they had 50,000 centrifuges, they only have 130, if they had 50,000 centrifuges, they could make a nuclear weapon in 16 days. They don't. And yet this is the headline and the first two paragraphs in Bloomberg News. Any blowback from that?
Not really. The talk was about El-Baradei's visit to Iran and his viewing of the sites or of what sites they're willing to show him and how that is going. But no, there was really no conversation about this. It's quite extraordinary that you can publish a thing like that in anything other than the Washington Times.
Yeah, it really is. I was astounded to see it, and Drudge is linking to it, has been all day, and it's got to cause a lot of people to, say, whoa, we better bomb them quick. And
people are already leaning that way.
Yeah.
And they don't help themselves. You've got Ahmadinejad standing up there like some kind of messianic lunatic, talking about what they've done. He doesn't help his case.
Well, not with us. He helps his case with the Iranian people, though. I mean, there's a strong wave of nationalism in Iran right now, which is the direct consequence of George W. Bush putting them on the list of the axis of evil. There's a strong pro-democracy movement in Iran that is now under assault because of our rhetoric.
And the only thing that could make it stronger would be to bomb Iran right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only that, you bomb Iran and you're going to see the entire Muslim crescent, Islamic crescent through that region just light up like a candle, like fireworks.
It's a very tricky situation. Iran is a genuine threat. It's not imminent, but it is a genuine threat, and we need to find a genuine way of dealing with it, and we don't know of one right now.
But I find it hard to believe that Iran is a genuine nuclear threat to us. They may be a threat to others in the region. They may be a threat to allies of ours. But why doesn't the region deal with that?
That's a very good question, Tom.
Yeah, because they don't have a missile that can reach the United States. I mean, I can understand, trying to take on the Soviet Union. John Kennedy did that. But anyhow, Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thanks for being with us today, Victoria, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Happy holidays. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. We'll be getting to your calls in a few minutes here. And if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, by the way, the address tomhartman.com on the internet, www.tomhartman.com, and just click live chat, and you can drop in and say hi. It is, however, the birthday of Thomas Jefferson. And so I wanted to share with you just a little bit of stuff about Thomas Jefferson for just a few minutes here. Jefferson, one of the big attacks on Jefferson, in fact, is that he was a slaveholder. And the conservatives in particular, they're trying to reinvent him since he founded the Democratic Party, trying to reinvent him as a, he was a slaveholder and therefore he was a hypocrite, et cetera, et cetera, because, he wrote all men are created equal. On February 27, 1787, now this was before the Constitution was ratified, in his notes on Virginia, he wrote, and I quote, this is an extraordinary insight in the nature and problem of slavery, and he honestly laid out his fears for the damage that slavery could wreak on the nation that he helped birth. This is after the just as the war had ended. He said, there must doubtless be an unhappy influence on the manners of our people produced by the existence of slavery among us. The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part and degrading submissions on the other. Our children see this and learn to imitate it, for man is an imitative animal. Jefferson saw slavery as an institution that was training future generations of Americans to submit to slavery by foreign or domestic governments or corporations. He went on, this quality is the germ of all education to him. They're talking about a child. From his cradle to his grave, he is learning to do what he sees others do. If a parent could find no motive, either in his philanthropy or his self-love, for restraint in the intemperance of passion toward his slave, it would always be sufficient one that his child is present. But generally, it's not sufficient. The parent storms, the child looks on, catches the lineaments of wrath, puts on the same airs in the circle of smaller slaves, gives a loose to the worst of passions, and thus nursed, educated, and daily exercised in tyranny, cannot but be stamped by it with odious peculiarities. Nobody, Jefferson said, except the most rare of individuals, could remain uncorrupted by slavery existing in a free society. He said the man must be a prodigy who can retain his manners and morals undepraved by such circumstances. So in the spring of 1770, so what was his position on slavery? Because he inherited these slaves from his father when he died, and his wife, when he married, she brought slaves with her. As Fawn Brodie, who wrote, in my opinion, the best biography, Thomas Jefferson, An Intimate History, writes, it deserves notice that his phrase, all men are born free, which appeared 6 years later in his Declaration of Independence, and which had been traced with the zealous scholarship to men of the Enlightenment, first came to Jefferson's lips publicly in the legal defense of a black man. In April of 1770, Jefferson was practicing law and defended a slave who was requesting his freedom. The case was called Howell versus Netherland. In his arguments on behalf of the slave, Jefferson said that, and I quote, under the law of nature, all men are born free, and everyone comes into the world with the right of his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it at his own will, end quote. A year before that, he'd written a law, he was a legislator in Virginia, 1769. This was long before the American Revolution. When he was in the House of Burgesses in Virginia, the Virginia legislature, he wrote a bill to abolish the importation of slaves into that state. It was unsuccessful, and it even brought down the wrath of many of his peers, and his relative, Richard Bland, who he had asked to introduce the proposed legislation. In 1774, he attacked King George for supporting slavery. In 1783, he again unsuccessfully attempted to amend Virginia's Constitution, proposing language that said, and I quote, the General Assembly shall not permit the introduction of any more slaves to reside in the state, or the continuance of slavery beyond the generation which shall be living on the 31st day of December, 1800, all persons born after that day being hereby declared free. Jefferson tried to end slavery in 1800. And that was back in 1783. This was, again, before the Constitution was even ratified. The next year, he proposed a national law banning slavery across the United States and in the Northwest Territories. That proposal lost by one vote. This is a terrible balancing act that Jefferson was struggling with. And when you get to his last days, Congressman John Holmes of Massachusetts wrote a letter in 1820 now. Now let's jump forward 50 years. It's now 1820. Jefferson was president from 1800 to 1808, or 1801 to 1809, actually. He's now an old man. Missouri and Maine are being admitted to the Union, and there's a fierce debate over whether Missouri should be allowed to join as a slave state, because Jefferson had helped pass legislation barring more slave states. And the only way that they could work this thing out in 1820, Jefferson is now old and retired, just six years before his death, was with a compromise. Congressman John Holmes of Massachusetts wrote to an elderly Thomas Jefferson to inform him of the compromise, and on April 22nd, 1820, just 6 years before his death, writing with a quill pen, his hands cramped by arthritis, Jefferson candidly expressed his despair in his response to his old friend and colleague. In it, he foresaw the day when the nation would be torn apart across what he called a geographical line. This is the Mason-Dixon line. He's predicting the Civil War here. over the issue of human beings being considered that kind of property, which is the phrase that was used then in polite company to describe slavery. Here's the letter. April 22nd, 1820. I thank you, dear sir, for the copy you have been so kind as to send me of the letter to your constituents on the Missouri question. See, what happened is they allowed Missouri to come in as a slave state if Maine wasn't. It is a perfect justification to them. I had for a long time ceased to read newspapers or pay any attention to public affairs, confident they are now in good hands and content to be a passenger in our bark, our canoe, to the far shore from which I am not distant. In other words, he's talking about, I'm going to die soon. But this momentous question of slavery in Missouri, like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I consider it at once as the death knell of the Union. It is hushed indeed for the moment, but this is a reprieve only, not a final sentence, a geographical line coinciding with a marked principle, moral and political. That would be slavery. Once conceived and held up to the angry passions of men, will never be obliterated, and every new irritation will mark it deeper and deeper. I can say with conscious truth that there is not a man on earth who would sacrifice more than I would to relieve us from this heavy reproach in any practicable way. The cessation of that kind of property, of slavery, for so it is misnamed, is a bagatelle, that would be a small issue, which would not cost me a second thought if in that way a general emancipation and extirpation could be effected. And gradually, and with due circumstances, I think it might be. But as it is, we have the wolf by the ears, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. He talked about slavery as a treason against the hopes of the world. Now, Jefferson had, keep in mind, when Jefferson introduced legislation in Virginia to free the slaves, his opponents, by way of punishing him, passed legislation in Virginia that said, if you free your slave and you don't give that slave enough money to live for the rest of their natural life and set them up in a place where they can live, then that slave will be captured, submitted to 2 years of Christian training by a local member of the clergy, and then sold at the auction block. So to free a slave was simply to put them out in the market and guarantee that they would be in worse circumstances than they are now. They made it impossible for him to free his own slaves because he didn't have that kind of money. I mean, you'd be very few of these guys. These guys were not the millionaires and billionaires of today. They had a lot of land. That was it. In fact, Jefferson died in bankruptcy. So anyhow, he's talking about slavery is a treason against the hopes of the world. He said, look to America as a beacon of liberty. He continues in this letter. I regret that I am now to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves by the generation of 1776 to acquire self-government and happiness to their country is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons, and that my only consolation is to be that I live not to weep over it. If they would but dispassionately weigh the blessings they will throw away against an abstract principle more likely to be affected by union than by scission, they would pause before they would perpetrate this act of suicide on themselves and of treason against the hopes of the world. He's talking about allowing another slave state. Now, it's easy for us in this day and age to look back 200 years and criticize Jefferson for all this. He used the cheap labor resource of his slaves to maintain his lifestyle, and the consequence of the failure of his efforts to abolish slavery was a bloody civil war, followed by 100 years of legal apartheid. Although he rationalized his slaveholding by keeping them in a style that exceeded that of most poor whites of the day, both were grim by today's standards, it was nonetheless a rationalization of slavery. His lifestyle was made possible by slave labor, and there's no other way to say it. Recognizing that fact, many Americans are righteously indignant and quick to judge him harshly. Yet how many of us would be willing to free our slaves? Right at this moment, I'm looking at a computer containing many parts made in countries where laborers are held with less freedom and in condition worse than those of Jefferson's slaves. My rationalization is that no companies in America or any other developed nation make any of those components any longer, and without parts from China and Malaysia, I wouldn't have a computer, but it's just a rationalization. It's no less hypocritical than just Jefferson's. sitting here, the shirt I'm wearing, made by modern-day slaves, the lamps lighting the room, manufactured in China. I can rationalize all the products of distant slaves that I use. After all, I don't have to look in their faces, as Jefferson did, which might account for why Fawn Brody noted that whenever he returned from a trip, he brought gifts for his slaves. The stark reality is that in America, we didn't end slavery. We simply exported it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Well, now it's about 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. And no, it doesn't cause rigidity and stiff thinking. Or no, I'm sorry. Adam in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Adam, thanks for calling the program.
Hi, Tom. I've really enjoyed the show this morning, and I'm a longtime listener, and I agree with you about 90% of the time, and I'm so happy you mentioned Thomas Jefferson.
It's his birthday today.
It is his birthday. Mine's on Monday, so it's near and dear to me. But as passionately and fervently as you feel about Thomas, and who maybe you were named for, I don't know if he was your namesake, but I feel similarly towards John Adams. And I feel that sometimes you give John Adams, you almost have to put him down in order to elevate Jefferson, following Jefferson's own lead. Remember, when Jefferson was governor of Virginia during the Revolutionary War, he ran and hid when the lobsters, the British troops, came near the state house where he was residing. He also had an affair long-term with Sally Hemings, who may have even been related to him through his father's loins, and I'm sure you're aware of that history.
She was actually the daughter and granddaughter of his wife's father and
That's right. And he didn't free his slaves even upon his death, which many people did.
He didn't
have
the
means
to.
We know
he did not have the means to.
Right, he was in debt. John Adams died in the black and left all his children farmland.
Yeah, I understand all that. And
I would love if you had a David McCullough or somebody who could argue the other side.
David McCullough so reinvented John Adams in that book and trashed Jefferson. And you look at his website and there's pictures of him arm in arm with George Herbert Walker Bush. This is part of the whole effort to bring back John. You know, John Adams with the Alien and Seditions Acts of 1898.
Yeah.
Was the most massive thing of his whole presidency. And yet it's got, what, 20 pages in McCullough's book?
Well,
I mean, he essentially doesn't even talk about it.
Preserving peace with France during the Jacobite, you know, revolution
It was Adams who was trying to stir up war. He was talking about how manly he was. But, you know, Adam, you and I only have a couple of minutes. I got a bunch of callers, and we're getting into historical minutiae
here. Here's the point, if I can. I'll just throw this out there.
Sure.
Jefferson said that a democracy needs to shed blood every few years. I'm paraphrasing, but something to that effect.
He said the tree of liberty periodically needs to be watered by the blood of patriots.
In Ultimate Sacrifice, you describe how one sort of path in the 60s that was popular in this country for dealing with our leaders and...
Well, let me just give you the caveat to what Jefferson said, first of all, because he later retracted that. He made that statement during the French Revolution in the 1890s. And or 1790s, and all of those guys, they all thought that early on. I mean, Tom Paine went to France to be part of the French Revolution. They put him in prison, nearly killed him. They all thought the French Revolution was going to be a clone of the American Revolution. They didn't understand who Maximilian Robespierre was and what a madman he was. And Jefferson making that comment, that was in support of the French Revolution. Within 2 years, he realized that he had supported, as did virtually all of the founders, that they had been supporting a madman and were all very quickly backpedaling away from the French Revolution. So that's not, I think, you know, if Jefferson were alive today, that's not a quote that he would be pleased that, you know, anybody was quoting, frankly.
Mm-hmm. And I think in relation to the build-up and the rhetoric towards war or possible airstrikes on Iran, as you're saying, we've externalized so much of our shadow outwardly.
Yes.
And that Iran is a convenient target to sort of distract and displace the anger, resentment, frustration that many Americans are feeling.
Yeah.
And not unlike the period we're talking about in the founding of our country, we all know that if the war had gone the other way and the British had won, many of our founding fathers would have gone to Canada. And some of us are thinking about that today.
Actually, they couldn't have gone to Canada because Canada was Great Britain. But that's where most of the truly rich people in the United States went after the Revolutionary War. Most of the wealth fled this country because it was conservative. It was Tory. And they went to Canada. They went back to England. But, you know, good point, Adam. And in fact, I'd also like to suggest that if you go to TomHartmann.com and click articles on democracy, if you scroll down, you will find there some one in particular really good article about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. It's probably in the first five or six down at the very bottom of the page. I forget the title. It talks about the Alien Sedition Acts. I've got to move along, though. Adam, thank you for the call. Jeff in South Hero, Vermont. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great. We have about a minute. What's up?
Okay, listen, I had a lot of points to make, and like I've been on the phone for a while and thinking about things. But about Jefferson, you know, I know you're a historian, but Jefferson took a lot from Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe you should read some quotes from Rousseau.
On the air, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the problem with reading Rousseau on the air, or any of those guys from the 17th century, is that, you know, it's pretty tough reading. I mean, there's pieces of it in What Would Jefferson Do?
But Jefferson was reading Rousseau. And second point I want to make.
Rousseau, by the way, for our listeners who aren't familiar, is the main thing that he's remembered for is this idea of the noble savage. But, you know, his first contribution, and John Locke then built on this with his second treatise on government, is that the fundamental nature of human beings is actually good, not evil, versus Thomas Hobbes, who thought it was the other way around.
All right.
So
I had a different comment to make, but okay.
Okay.
You have a good day, man.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jeff. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's amazing. It's happy Jefferson's birthday. Coming up tomorrow, Congressman Bernie Sanders, of course, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Conservative Angelo Codevilla is going to be showing up, a true endangered species conservative critical of Bush's foreign policy. And Jeffrey Kleinman with DVD Talk going to be here to talk about the latest DVD flicks and with a message. That and your calls and more. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information.